Thank you all for coming. It's nice to see you all here. I'm very pleased to welcome Danny Doyling here, the author of Inequality of the 1%, who's going to do us a little chat, and we're going to open up to a bit of a discussion.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for the invite. Well done. Well done on lasting this long. Most occupations in universities don't last this long nowadays. I'll just talk to you for about 5 or 10 minutes about why I'm here. Please feel free to interrupt me. And then I desperately need you to interrupt me after about 10 minutes because I've only got about 10 minutes worth of stuff I really want to say to you. I'm just going to tell you that what I think the history of the corporate university is, where it's currently going in the current year, and then I'm interested in your ideas about where it might go in the future. I'm only here because in the 1930s, my granddad got government funding to go to university. It was a complete mess in the 1930s. It depended on which county you lived in, whether you managed to get anything, but it did actually exist. And so he went to university. His sisters all went to the mill at 14. That's what almost everybody did. And the assistance was so much that he could buy himself a blazer and even some furniture with the money. That's what the grant was like in the 30s, and there were no fees. In the 1960s, my mum and dad went to university. By then, they'd managed to cut some of the maintenance grants if your parents were very well off. My dad had his maintenance cut off from his family, but the grant was so good that my mum and dad could actually live on one grant, and there were no fees. I go to university in the 1980s, no fee still, but the grant has got smaller and smaller. The grant then goes. The grant does exist in many parts of Europe. I mean, it's worth remembering this. The grant goes, but we still don't get fees. Margaret Thatcher never introduced fees. John Major is on the record of saying that every year the Treasury suggested to him that they introduce fees, and every year John Major stopped it. He just said this would be a very bad thing, it will be the start of a slippery slope. So it was a new Labour government that introduced a £1,000 fee. And I think the key thing to remember about that is that introducing something very small can have a much bigger effect later on. And you can use that for positive things. When people are campaigning, say, to get a very, very small citizen's wage, just think about the very small £1,000 fee. Getting something in on principle is the hardest thing to do. Once you get it in on principle, it's relatively easy then to change the amount. So fees then go up to £3,000, and then you get the crucial point that you're now in. We're in the first year in which all 3 years of undergraduates are paying £9,000. £9,000 came in, as far as I can tell, and it'll all be documented far more carefully in the future when everything comes out, primarily because of the financial crash of 2008. The financial crash of 2008 meant that if government was going to carry on in the way it was going to have to cut. And so it cut the armed forces, it cut the police, and you're looking at cuts of 20% here, which is mainly done by just not hiring new people. It cut a whole series of budgets. Government departments have lost half their staff since 2008, and looming over universities was the idea that we were going to be facing a cut, and a massive cut, you know, a quarter of staff. So if you're like me, the question is which one of your colleagues is going to go? And that, in an environment that already isn't much fun, that's not much fun. Peter Mandelson was the minister who had the power at the time. Peter Mandelson was the one who set up the Brown Commission. And Peter Mandelson, in alliance with David Willetts from the Conservatives, set up the commission in such a way, and in effect with instructions, that they would come out with the recommendation of unlimited fees, and certainly 9,000 not being a problem. That murky history of how that happened is well worth looking into. But the reason it happened so easily, and the reason there was so little opposition to £9,000 fees was that all the people teaching you who were interested in these kind of things, at the back of their mind, knew that if they opposed fees, they'd be looking at job cuts. The only political party, as you know, to oppose this was the Liberals, and they didn't oppose it particularly effectively, it turns out. I do wonder if the coalition agreement had gone differently in those 4 days in 2010 after the election, and we had had a Labour-Liberal coalition, and if one or two Liberals hadn't lost their seats who were particularly against fees, things could have been very different. But as it was, Nick Clegg was told, you're going to have mass redundancies in universities or you're going to have to accept fees. And he accepted fees. So they're in. I have not met anybody who thinks they're sustainable. And I meet a lot of people. I meet people across a wide range of the political spectrum. I've met nobody who thinks that this finance system is actually going to work median term, in that students are actually going to repay the fees at a high enough rate, and that's only 50% of what you're actually given out and then the interest is charged to actually make the whole thing work. It's all about short term getting through 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14, and putting off the day of working out what you really do. I don't get to meet the small group of people who really ardently believe that a fully privatised higher education system is the way to go. But it's easy to see that they are very, very effective. The latest thing that's happened is that the number controls on universities this year have gone entirely. The number controls began by saying that any university could take any number of students with AAB and then any number of students with ABB, but this year they've gone. So this September, any university in Britain can take any number of students they can entice in with the incentive that they'll get those fees if they get them, or with the incentive that if they don't play the game, the other universities that are playing the game will survive and they will die. What you're seeing this year already is an unprecedented number of unconditional offers being made, all kinds of changes to the process of enticing people to come in, partly out of fear, I'd say largely out of fear. We've had number controls for as long as I've been alive. Before number controls, if a university took 0.5% more than it was allowed or 0.5% less, it received a fine that went up with every fraction of a percent you're out. So all universities know is how to behave in a way that gets the same number of students as before. Now they're facing an experimental free market, and the outcome of that in September, October is unlikely to be pretty. People had a little bit less sex 19 years ago, or were using condoms even more effectively. But the point of saying this is that we have a fixed number of 18, 19-year-olds and actually dropping slightly for the next few years. So you're playing a game with a cake that's getting smaller. And if your university succeeds in this game, if they employ enough people in marketing and sack people who are doing other things, and they manage to produce enough posters and enough TV adverts, and you'll see lots of those in the next few months, then you can increase your intake 10%, 20%, 30%. You've got to find some way of getting them all into lecture theatres. It'll be quite tricky. The limiting factor is beds, if you look at a city or a space. But some universities will appear to be winners, except for them, of course. Suddenly they're having to deal with a larger number of students than they expected to get. They're unlikely to do a particularly good job with that. And other universities will be losers. There'll be a shock. The students won't turn up. No university will probably close, just like schools tend not to close. They'll merge with a neighbouring institution. That is how you close a university. You say it's merging, and suddenly these courses are not running because they're not economic anymore. Within universities, more departments will close, and some departments will grow very large. Part of the reason why there's been such an increase in people going to universities recently, particularly people from poorer areas, I mean, not huge, but an extra child in every 30, is because what else do you do when you're 18 or 19 now? What else do you do? What job is it that you actually go for? Where do you go travelling abroad to work when there are 25 million people unemployed under the age of 25 in Europe? So this is all happening at a time when the options for the customers are limited. The customers are children. The point at which you made the decision to go to university, I think in almost all of your cases, was when you were 16 or 17. I couldn't sell you a car on hire purchase as a 17-year-old. It would be illegal. You're not allowed to court children and get them to enter into these kind of agreements. Universities are very careful. They get you to sign only when you're 18 that you're actually agreeing to pay the fee for a loan. But at some point, some students are going to go probably to the European Court and say, I was convinced as a child to do this by all the marketing that was aimed at me. And there's a question about when that will happen. That's enough on the students. I could carry on about what happens to students with all of this, but it's just worth saying something about the staff of universities. Being a member of university staff has become dramatically more precarious in recent years. Losing number controls makes it more precarious. Universities end up giving more and more temporary contracts to people because they, particularly now, more now than at any other time and probably more than in the future, universities don't know how big they're going to be. You know, because it depends on the market. And this is a market where we don't have a market, so we can't judge it. So teaching staff are given temporary contracts. Staff who are given permanent contracts, this is admin, technical staff, academic staff, it's not really a permanent contract. It just entitles you to slowly build up some potential redundancy pay if and when you're seen as not being needed anymore. And it's the insecurity for staff is the thing that you notice most. And then people start behaving in ways which they wouldn't have behaved in before. They start doing things that they're asked to do by higher management, grading their colleagues and so on in ways that they would have resisted before because they're scared for their own jobs. And one of the saddest things that I've seen in the last few years, I mean, I'm 46, so I'm looking at this in a different way for most of you, is I've watched colleagues behave in ways that I knew they don't want to behave in, but because they're scared for themselves and their own families. And at the top of university hierarchies, management actually feel increased pressure. They're not immune to this. They have a sense of how much they're often disliked. Tragically, they have a tendency to compensate themselves for the increased pressure of the job compared to 10 or 20 years ago by paying themselves more, saying it's a harder job. But it stretches all the way to the very top of institutions. People at the very top are much more scared than they were in the future. And we don't do things in solidarity. So in Japan, I was in Japan a few years ago at a university in Kyoto. They suddenly had a drop in their income. And what they did in Japan is that everybody in the university didn't get paid for a month. It was quite tricky, but the idea that you'd sack anybody doesn't fit with Japanese university culture. You're all in it together in Japan. You don't move around universities much. You stay in your university, you're part of it. And so if the money suddenly runs out, everybody doesn't get paid for a month, nobody gets sacked. There are very different models and ways of behaving in different places. There is some good news. That's the good news. Increasing numbers of universities are paying a living wage. Universities are better than other parts of what's now the private sector. Not a single high street shop is paying the living wage, clothes shops, not any of the big chains. So universities are beginning to do that. But they're partly doing it because they're actually finding it quite hard to get staff on below living wage, particularly in places like London and Oxford, where I'm from, where it's absolutely impossible to live on this because of the cost of housing. And the cost of housing is implicated in all these things. There are places where the students don't realise how important the living wage campaign is. My favourite place is the University of Reading. Reading, to keep itself going, I don't know if this happens in the LSE, but Reading employs extremely large numbers of its own students who are paying £9,000 a year to be there, to work the cafeterias and the library, and pays them, I believe, £5 an hour, because you're allowed to do that if somebody is 18 or 19. And it amazes me. I can understand when students don't take part in campaigns when it doesn't directly benefit them. But if the students at the University of Reading demanded and worked more to get the living wage in Reading, they'd actually be getting a tiny fraction of their £9,000 back more directly in their pay for helping the University of Reading actually run itself. But there are good news stories on that. There are good news stories in a number of academics who are increasingly politicised about all these things, although they tend to worry most about their pensions when their pensions are threatened. But the atmosphere that all is okay and a hierarchical society is great is breaking down. And lastly, before you start shouting out at me or asking how can I sit here, given the fact that I'm actually paid from these £9,000 fees as well, there are a growing number of movements who are saying that this isn't good enough, that are occupying places, that are campaigning. These have a huge effect. It doesn't matter how small it is, the effect is enormous. If you don't do it, then there's a group who will say, and do say, students had a little bit of a campaign, they did that little march, somebody was a bit silly and threw something off a roof, but really they don't mind that much. If they minded, they would be campaigning more. So if you want any reason to do this, you need to do it to stop that argument, because that argument can be very powerful. You know, if it was that bad, why wouldn't the students be campaigning? You can have effects. The biggest effect you've had to date is quite a remarkable effect. From one of the most apathetic Labour parties ever, you've got a pledge from the leader of the Labour Party that fees will be reduced to £6,000 a year if he's Prime Minister. I think it's good. It's further the way to what we need. But given the lack of general pledges on things, that is a very impressive pledge. You've also had vice chancellors who have not opposed it. They all say that you need to make up the money because nobody wants to sack people. And there's no need to be sacking people at the moment. But the fact that that's one political party has actually put that in as a pledge, I don't think is an entirely cynical to try to get student votes. I think it's a bit cynical, but I don't think it's entirely cynical. If students could get politically organised, my suggestion for students, and it always fails, is stop dividing yourselves up into the main political parties, talk to each other, try to make an agreement about what's in the interests of students, work out that we have a first-past-the-post system in this country, which means that blocks of people who are geographically concentrated can be incredibly powerful. That's how the Labour Party began, with the votes of miners. Miners are incredibly geographically concentrated. You are incredibly geographically concentrated in a small number of parliamentary constituencies. I'm not a member of any party, I should say, but this is the one I'd go for. There is one political party which only has one MP at the moment, that might get two, with whom you could negotiate. And as a student body, say you can deliver the student votes to the Green Party if the Green Party will look a bit more closely at student issues. It's what the Green Party needs if the Green Party is to begin to move towards a normal European Green Party, which is a decent number of MPs. And of course, the seats that you happen to be geographically located in the country are also the seats where the bohemian, guardian, reading middle class like to live, who are also more likely to vote Green. So if you want the suggestion of a political way forward, that's the way. The tragedy is that so many students in student politics have got their eye on a long-term career and are working with one of the three main parties, because nowadays a precarious career as a political hack and a researcher and an MP looks really safe and stable compared to many jobs. And so student politics is still dominated by the three main parties. And I think it's well worth thinking after this election, is there a way of aligning a student vote with that Green vote? Not that you all have to agree with the Green Party, but just because the convenience is so very, very high. And lastly, why am I bothered, before you ask me? I've got kids. It's really easy. I've got kids. Even if I was completely self-centred, I only believed in myself and my family and there's no such thing as society, what's currently happened makes no sense for me because I have three children. And they may not be so adventurous that they go and do something else instead. They travel if they can. They work if you can get jobs. Or they're brave and they just go to Europe. They might not be that adventurous. They might actually go to university in Britain and incur the same kind of debts and situation that you get. And even if they think of being adventurous, if we leave the EU in a couple of years' time, that exit route to Europe and to free higher education is going to be cut off for my children. So no matter how selfish I am in myself, I need the UK higher education system to be sorted out just for my family, let alone for the fact that I'm probably going to be working in it for the next 20 years and I'd like to exit and retire saying it's so much better than it was in the middle of my career, with people of your age in 20 years' time saying, but it's still terrible, it needs to improve, because that's how things get better and better and better. Please ask away, tell me what I've missed, ask me why I haven't talked about particular groups. Anything at all.
I'm just curious about this 9,000 and Labour wanting to reduce it to 6,000. My understanding is that most universities, for large part, depend on international fees, student fees, which is £18,000.
Yeah.
So will it make that, I mean, that's the primary cash cow, if I'm not mistaken. So will 6,000, 9,000 really make a difference to universities?
Okay. It's actually only a small number of universities that rely on international students, but it's the majority of the Russell Group. There are a lot of universities now, because all the ex-polys became universities and a whole lot of former FE colleges have been allowed, teaching colleges, to become universities. So it's a very wide sector. In most of that sector, there are very few international students. But in the summer, the LSE is typical. It's absolutely dependent on international students. I spent the last 10 years working in the University of Sheffield before I moved down to Oxford. When I arrived at Sheffield, this must be about 12 years ago, we had hardly any international students. When I left, not really much due to our own efforts, but when I left, a quarter of the students were international, China, Malaysia, and so on. The word Sheffield is associated with steel worldwide. It's actually a very good brand worldwide. It's not necessarily a brilliant brand in Britain, where it's associated with the full Monty, and so on. Those students, a quarter of the 60,000 students of the city, brought in more money to South Yorkshire than the entire metal industry. And that happened within 10 years. It was quite an incredible switch. And it's when you've got to think differently. When you're in a county where the money was running out and your main industry was not doing particularly well, you can see why getting the income from overseas was attractive. But there is a danger that UK universities are going to become Swiss finishing schools, and that one of the main major earnings for the country is charging very high fees to educate the children of the international rich. It's partly the reason why there's not much opposition to it is we're still reeling from discovering that our bankers weren't that good. So if our bankers are not that good, what can we do next? As a country which long ago lost the ability to make manufacturing goods that would sell, or lost the ability to control half the world and force them to buy our manufacturing goods, which is partly how we did it. So there's seen to be a future in international students coming. It would be nice to imagine 10 or 20 years' time that this country is full of international students, but the cost has gone down because there should be no need to charge that much. I mean, how much does it actually cost to give somebody a few dozen lectures, you know, arrange some seminars, operate a library for them, and so on? So I could be positive about where this could go. The danger is that if the people in charge are just thinking about how much money we can make, then we're going the opposite direction. And of course, it could also change the country. Getting in large numbers of people from abroad, particularly people who are not all the children of the very rich, is one way of altering what is quite a parochial country to make it more cosmopolitan. In Oxford, a quarter of the population are now overseas born. The proportion isn't just going up, it's accelerating. It's across the social scales, it's the majority of new academic hires, of course some of the students, but it's also increasingly the people who clean the colleges and so on are from outside. And it's interesting to watch that change. So I'm against charging people an absolute fortune for something which it's very hard to show actually cost that much money. But given what else is happening in UK politics, it's nice to watch the country becoming more cosmopolitan. And I've yet to see UKIP complain about Oxford. You know, say, this is terrible, what's happening in the city of Oxford. No doubt they will. They haven't quite caught up with it yet.
There's been quite a lot of talk at LSE about them lifting the cap on tuition fees, raising it to £12,000. I was wondering if you know anything about that.
That's the desire of a series of people. When the Brown Commission sat, most universities sent in a submission to it. It's quite hard to find those submissions on the web now. They're really interesting documents, so I decided to download them all at the time. So if anybody wants a copy of the LSE submission to Brown Review, just let me know. They're public documents. Oxford and Cambridge very conveniently said the real cost of a degree here is £16,000 and £17,000. They're not allowed under competition law to compare notes or anything, which makes universities incredibly jittery about talking about this, because they're supposed to make out they never talk to each other about what they want and what fee levels they're going to set. But there is a desire amongst people, this is only the poshest, say, 5% of universities, to head towards US fees. The thinking here is that American universities are supposedly great because they have so much money, and they have so much money because they can charge such high fees. And you can charge these really high fees, partly because the US students have unbelievable loans, partly because some are very, very rich, that you can have a few bursaries and some token poor children there, but you can produce the most amazing science from it. Once you look at the output of US universities and divide it by the size of the country, you find that that argument goes. US universities are actually not that good. UK universities, ironically, before the £9,000 come in, were far, far better per head, before you charge more, at producing things, at generating patents, at writing academic papers, and so on. But there's certainly a desire in some quarters, if you have a majority Conservative government, yeah, you should expect the cap to come off fees. That's the writing's on the wall for that. That then skews what people then choose to do. Because if you get an average job, you're looking at paying back about £56,000. If you get a slightly better than average job, you're looking around about £100,000. So there's a temptation to try and get a really well-paid job. The only large stock of really well-paid jobs in the country are a few jobs in law in London, in finance in London, and in economics in London. So you have a set of students, right at the top of society, elite, heading towards those particular occupations. None of this is sustainable. Luckily, we've got the US to go first, so we can kind of observe from the US. It's a bit like obesity. The US got fat first, so we're going to get some warning of what happens when you eat too much from them as well. And if you're trying to explain all of this, the United States is a world power which is declining in power, and doesn't know its place in the world and has run out of money. It has this massive, massive debt. And we're a kind of similar little version of that. So if you ask me, why are the US and the UK doing this? And to an extent, Australia and South Korea. That's about it. The rest of the rich world does things differently. Part of it is not being willing to face up to the realities of no longer being able to get so much money from the rest of the planet. Because the reason my granddad could go to university and be so well funded in the 1930s was that this country still had an empire in the 1930s. So it was people from India who in effect were paying for his grant. It just works its way out long. The reason now why we can't carry on as before is that all that money that sloshed around the city of London before, and we took a take from it, there's been a massive reduction in that. And so we have to do something different. We've got to tighten our belts in various ways. But universities, you know, I know you need labs for some things and, you know, some courses cost more than others, but here at the LSE, are any of you using test tubes? Are any of you cutting up bodies? You know, are any of you, apart from a library, what is the expensive thing that you need that the university is having to provide you, which means you'll have to charge £12,000? It's a bit like asking landlords, how come the rent on this property is 20 times what it was 20 years ago when nothing's happened to the building? You know.
You haven't spoken much about the role of inequality.
Yes.
Do you have to say something about that?
I should say something about inequality in all this, yeah. Well, it plays a part, so a strong part. I spent some time a long time ago in Santa Barbara, which is a very affluent part of the west coast of America. And there's a university there in Santa Barbara. It's where Michael Jackson had his ranch, and Ronald Reagan went to retire, and John Cleves lived. And I travelled around on the buses. And the interesting thing about using a bus in Santa Barbara, if you're white, is that nobody else is white on the buses, except for the children. And they're on the buses because they can't drive. And I asked the kids what they were doing, and they said that they were going off to cram for their SATs. And I said, why? They said, because if they don't pass their SATs and get into university, they're facing a life of serfdom. You know, just minimum wage jobs for the rest of their lives. So in really unequal countries like the United States, the impetus to go to college and university is massive. It's the same as it is here. In more equitable places like Japan and like Germany, you don't have to go to university. You don't have to go at 18. There's something particularly silly, I think, about having to go at 18, 19. Because you might not be sure what you want to do. It's a really bad age at 17 to decide you want to be a medic and spend the rest of your life with ill people. And the worst thing now is that if you make the mistake now, you've got to pay back the fee for the course that you drop out of. So more unequal countries reduce the number of options to the young, channel them to particular directions. They reduce respect for people doing jobs that don't necessarily require going to university. My preference would be that we allow everybody to go to university at some point in their life. But if you want a way of getting out of fees now, because it's quite hard to immediately stop things, I would introduce a rule that says if you defer, each year you defer, the less the fees will be. This doesn't cost government anything in the short term because people simply put off going to university and then they choose at age 30 to go. It would hurt the universities because the universities desperately want every last 18 and 19-year-old who can get in to go. Over half of all young women are now going to university. So university in Britain is no longer elite. You know, when people say, we have to charge you fees because this is a middle-class treat, right? Majority of 18, 19-year-old women in England are going to university. That's about a third heading towards 40% of young men. But inequality makes it easier to do this. If this was a far more equitable country, if graduate jobs didn't pay so much more than normal jobs, why would you see people who are marginal about going to university being willing to sign up for this debt to go?
Why do you think everything's become like about debt and the deficit? Is it like an ideological assault, or is it just a lack of imagination, or what is it?
What's going on? 2008 was massive. It was as big as the 1929 crash. So it wasn't a real thing in the way that the world economy is discussed. You know, you can argue about whether all this money is real in the banks and so on, but within the world, within that world, this was absolutely huge. People, years later, who were at the meeting in Washington that weekend on behalf of Gordon Brown, when they decided what to do so the cash points would still run on the Monday or Tuesday, you can talk to them about it and you can watch the blood drain from their faces when they remember it. They were really scared about what would happen. And so part of the reason you get so much worry about debt and deficit is that. Now, the deficit is tiny compared to previous deficits that we've held. The debt is large. Our debt is actually equal in proportion to the debt of Greece. It's just that the Greek debt was in short-term bonds. A lot of the UK debt is in longer-term bonds. So it's not an immediate problem. But the main reason the three main parties are basically singing the same tune with a tiny difference between them is because they were educated in that kind of way of thinking. And the alternatives are scary because international money flees from a country when it begins to behave differently. I'm fairly mild-mannered in that I wouldn't try and do a solution in one country thing here. I would do cuts, it's just that my cuts would start with Trident, and then there's a whole other set of things which we could cut which are harmful, which why not take the opportunity now to do that. We could also cut easily the amount of money we spend trying to keep house prices up. The Chancellor has spent more money in every budget since 2010 on measures to make the house prices and rents higher and higher than anything else. He's committed 130 billion, potentially, of guarantees for Help to Buy. Every budget, there's been something else to keep house prices high and hence rents high. The amount of money you could save by not spending government money trying to make it expensive to live in Britain would be enormous. The housing benefit bill's enormous. There's no need to pay all these landlords who are not doing anything to their property for this. You can begin to wind it down, but you know, I'm a mild-mannered 46-year-old. I've got kids. I'm not into revolution. But you can dramatically improve the living standards of everybody in Britain by reducing the cost of housing. You can make students much better off by your rents coming down. You introduce mild rent regulation. I used to call it rent control, and I've learned to call it mild rent regulation. Right, it's exactly the same thing, just more palatable. if you do that. But if you can bring the cost of housing down and renting down, it's less important to try to bring wages up, or to, you don't have to increase living wage so fast. Because there's no point having a living wage in London if the rents are going up faster than it. There's a huge amount that can be done within part of the orthodox idea of how an economy works. There's just an enormous reluctance to entertain this from our three main parties. Partly because people went into politics in those parties, put it blunt, because they believe that inequality is good for the Conservative Party. For the Labour Party, they believed that a little bit of tinkering might help, but essentially still greed was good. There is part of the Labour Party which is more imaginative than that, which is the part where you get the £6,000 fee from, where you get the commitment to three-year tenancies from. That part of the Labour Party spends all its time fighting with the other part of the Labour Party. And it's an old politics. Then the new politics, Trident, has suddenly become a possibility. I had lunch today with somebody called Bruce Kent. Have any of you heard of Bruce Kent? He used to run CND when I was a child. This nice man spent his whole life trying to get nuclear disarmament. Bruce is now 85. Bruce never ever imagined in a very long lifetime that the way that Trident might go was the Scottish National Party. Never imagined. And you need to hold on to things like this. Because when new stuff happens and interesting stuff happens, it often comes completely out of left field. And it's easy to get pessimistic and think nothing can happen. The SNP, their deal, if they are going to form a coalition with Labour, one of their deals is that Trident is not renewed. You cannot apparently put those submarines anywhere else in UK waters. It doesn't work. It's a great cost saving. Labour could blame it on the SNP and just sort of said, we'd have to. They'd also say, we're not renewing it, we're just putting it off as they rust and rust and rust. But suddenly, unilateral nuclear disarmament is an option. Now,
do you think the house prices thing is partly because like rising house prices is quite a good pacifier, sort of makes a lot of people getting a lot richer, so it sort of puts them off?
It's part of certainly the well, and I mean, what I could do, I find it's much harder to do. I want to do things like this where I have a top hat and then I put the top hat on my head and I try to give you the logic from the other side. Let me just try that now, just for a second. So imagine I'm wearing a top hat. This is really hard to do. So I'm being Boris and George. High house prices are a sign of success. They're a sign of economic success. Successful wealth creators from around the world want to come here more than anywhere else and are willing to pay a fortune to be here because this is the entrepreneurial place to be on the planet. The alternative is Dublin, halving of house prices, Madrid, Italy, Iceland, Greece. What do you want? Do you want to be one of those? But we've managed to keep Britain great. Even though we're on the periphery of Europe, we're the only place that's managed to keep our house prices high. This is wealth for people's retirement. It's wealth they can pass on because they've worked hard for it. Nobody has a lot of money if they haven't worked hard for it. It's wealth that they can pass on to their children, and that's a good thing. It's wealth that inspires other people to have aspiration to become entrepreneurs and become wealthy too and create the kind of jobs we need. And innovation and vacuum cleaners, because that's what we're really good at, vacuum cleaners that can be sold the world over and that were made in Britain. It's a measure of London's success. And I'm afraid if you can't afford to live in London, there are lots of other places you could live and go to, but you're just not good enough for the market. And the market has decided that you're not good enough. this is the future. It's about winning the global race. We're the men to do it. We know about racing. Anything else is heading to the 1970s, and they were really terrible, and you don't want that. That's no, enough of that. I won't try and do that again.
You talked a little bit about Europe earlier in your talk, and I was wondering what you think the role of Europe is to do with equality and what will happen depending on the outcome of the election.
Okay, on Europe. I'm unlike most people from my part of politics, I'm quite in favour of Europe. Well, I should say, unlike most people from my part of politics in England, where Europe is seen as a banker's kind of club, which in many ways it is. The Council of Ministers are not elected, and they decided to do things differently. But in mainland Europe, younger people of your age tend to have a very different idea about Europe. It's freedom. It's your freedom to move around, to work where you want, to escape the boredom of where you grew up, to see different things. And it's freedom not to have to fight a war. We keep forgetting the reason Europe was established was to prevent a third world war, at least starting in Europe. If you look at things, even in Germany, pretty right-wing country at the moment, the German government has just enacted a new series of rent controls to make renting even better in Germany. The last German state a few months ago got rid of the tiny fees that they had, so that all university education is free in Germany. This is under Merkel. We are the dunce of the class in Europe. We are the most unequal country. Our poorest fifth are the poorest fifth of all of Western Europe, absolutely. The middle household in this country, the median household, has a lower income than the middle household in Germany and less than the middle household in France. We keep on talking about how France doesn't work. Our middle household is worse off than in France, and that's even before you take into account house prices. So we do really badly. So you could complain about Europe and say how it's not ideal, but given how poor we are performing as a country, it actually is beneficial to us. It stops us doing things like introducing a guest worker scheme that we might otherwise do. And our kids have got the freedom to study anywhere in Europe. It's stunning how parochial we've become. You know, when I was 18, as a middle-class boy, the thing you did as a middle-class boy was go away from home. So I went to Newcastle from Oxford. I went as far away as I could in England. I wasn't that daring. But nowadays, you can go anywhere in this continent away. And it's amazing we haven't seen a big rise in people travelling away. It's partly because you had to find somebody who'll pay the airfares. There were other costs involved. I think it'll tear the Conservative Party apart if they win the election, this coming referendum. It's possible it might bring an economic crash forward, and certainly a crash on the housing market forward, if the Conservatives were to win outright, because you simply play out what leaving Europe would actually mean for the UK, how many things wouldn't begin to work. Not least, my university, Oxford, at least the faculty I'm in, over a third of all our income comes from the European Union. Actually, there's more coming into sciences with all the nuclear stuff that goes on. So what's my university going to do if it loses a third of its income? What happens to all those researchers and everybody else? And then what happens to the economy of Oxford? What happens to London with all of this? So, you know, there's trouble ahead.
Where is that income from investments?
No, that income's from the European Science Foundation, ESF. Of all the regions of Europe, and you know, Europe's now very wide, the region that gets the highest amount of European Science Foundation funding per head is Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire and Berkshire. Right? We are highly successful at pulling in money from Europe, and this is money we won't be entitled to if we leave. And our own government could suddenly try and stump up this money. It's far more money than we pay in. We get out more than we pay in. but our universities are in trouble. That's before you think about all the European students who come. I mean, it's surprising that quite a lot still come, even though it's £9,000. Once they have to pay £18,000, you know, and there's a danger of UK universities being labelled as somewhere you come if you're rich and thick, right? Not clever enough to go somewhere that doesn't charge you this much, like a Swiss finishing school. And the Swiss have now stopped basing part of their economy on having finishing schools. It's not a great way forward.
You talk in your book about, at the end, needing a slow revolution. And you just said now you're not in favour of revolution. So I can kind of assume what you mean by that is kind of, you know, gradual change rather than kind of fundamental change. It's interesting because you also cite, you know, the Green Party as someone to vote for, and I completely agree, like, in the here and now, that's it's definitely the best option we've got. But I was at the This Changes Everything event on Saturday, which, although it's about climate change, I think there's a lot of similarities in the sense that, you know, these are problems that we have the resources to solve, but no one's actually solving them. And Natalie Bennett, as well as, you know, Naomi Klein, Paul Mason, Russell Brand, all the big speakers, they all talked about the need for systematic change, for structural change, for radical change, and openly just using the word revolution. I mean, all of those to me kind of sound like synonyms for revolutionary change. And do you not think that actually the reason that people are drawing those sort of conclusions about something like climate change, and I think about lots of other issues, is because they've seen the inability of, say, leaders like Francis Hollande in France, or even like Syriza in Greece, to try and change anything through kind of little piecemeal reform, and they find themselves up against, you know, the people you talk about in your book, the 1% who make all the real decisions and who aren't elected at all. Like, do you not think that kind of implies, therefore, the need for actually much more drastic change? Not, you know, Robespierre, blood on the street type stuff, but I mean, just, you know, measures that go way beyond just tax and spend, basically.
Okay, yeah. In a way, I mean, what most of the 1% get to do is work directly for the 0.1% who make all the decisions, but they get to be in the room and they get enough money not to worry about housing, but actually not enough to amass much wealth. I go for slow revolution partly because so many people like Paul and Russell and so on are saying something bigger, so there's enough people saying that. And if you don't talk about the advantages of just changing things slowly, as I'll say, as well, I mean, I could tell you my sort of worries about doing things more quickly, but if you don't talk of the advantages of slow change, people get very, very pessimistic and put off politics. They just think anything is pointless. It's my granddad's experience. My granddad went to university, well, he was born in 1916, so he went around about 1935, and you got to remember there'd been the crash in 1929. There was mass unemployment in 1935, unemployment the country had never seen before. His generation of young men, they're almost all men, completely distrusted their parents' generation. Their parents had utterly failed. Their parents had an economic model that was bankrupt. They could see it wasn't working. Their parents told them, "Oh, just carry on, we'll sort it out, don't worry, it'll get back again to what it was like in 1928. That wasn't the case, and so this set of university students in the 30s never believed the bankers again. And now they did have to go out and fight a war, but when they came back, they stood for seats in 1945, they won a landslide, they brought in a welfare state, they brought in a health service, tragically they also brought in nuclear missiles quietly. They carried on in the 1950s, they built more council houses, they even convinced the Conservative Party to build more council houses than Labour. They changed our school system so that schooling was free in 1944. They then introduced comprehensive schools so you could go to schools for everybody else in the late 1960s, 1970s. That was a slow revolution. That was a change that occurred to a generation that carried it through, partly because of what happened to them when they were young. You are so similar to that generation. Students a bit older than you, who graduated before the crash. It's very different to ones who graduate after it. And so it's recognising that things happen slowly. Or look at Scandinavian countries. They didn't suddenly have a revolution. Or Denmark didn't become a pretty nice place to live overnight. There was a gradual change in these societies to get to the point of having cooperative schooling systems, to having in Norway a system whereby if you don't take your paternity leave of many months, your colleagues stop talking to you. So the relationship between men and women differs. A huge amount of what's been achieved in places in the world where it's been achieved has been gradual, cutting away, slow effort. There tend to be tipping points. The First World War may have been one tipping point in the crash. There was another tipping point in the 1970s where we became ever more equal after then. We may be at a tipping point now. When you're at a tipping point, you have to keep on working away at it for most of your lifetime to achieve what people achieved before. You can't just expect one magic moment. The fastest way to become a really equal country, like Japan or Germany, is to lose a war. It's not actually having a revolution. It's losing a war. That's what happened to those countries. So sudden events can make things very different. A pandemic would, if we got a flu pandemic. I can go through many of these possibilities, but they're just not ones that strike you with great optimism. But the point is, Andy Haldane, I think he keeps changing his job title. I think he's now chief economist of the Bank of England. But Andy Haldane goes around the country and the world repeatedly saying just how dodgy the banks are still. There are many, we now know just how uncertain the immediate future is. We also know that Europe and North America are becoming poorer in the world. The real adjustment is happening versus China at a faster rate than before. There's a danger if you advocate. I mean, tell me, what is the kind of thing you are suggesting? So not Robespierre, but what?
Well, the first thing I was going to say was you mentioned all the gradual change after the Second World War, but then the thing that makes me believe there's radical change is needed is the fact that all those things we won through gradual change after the Second World War are actually now being taken away, just actually very quickly, like yes. The NHS, like council housing, like nationalised industries. I mean, they've either gone or yes. So it's kind of like we worked all that gradual time to win little by little crumbs off the table, and then you can have it snatched away very quickly, actually. And in a process, it's actually before 2008, even, like, Piketty's book talks about inequality rising since the beginning of the 80s. But in terms of radical change, you say there's a 1% there that controls this vast amount of wealth, then make that publicly owned. Rather than try and tax them and see them shimmy it off into offshore accounts, why aren't we nationalising the banks and the, 50 or so companies that control, the whole economy, basically?
Not much. Yeah, well, we had an option to nationalise the banks.
Yeah, we did, but we nationalised the debts and privatised the profits.
We privatised banks, yeah. We may still have an option to nationalise the banks next time. In New Zealand, they've nationalised a bank. It's called Kiwi Bank. Many things are actually possible, and that isn't because people had pitchforks in New Zealand.
I agree, I'm not suggesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You need protests and people doing things, but things have happened. It did take 30 years for them to unravel, and they still haven't fully unraveled what was achieved, but they do have a wish to unravel it. It's over the land. 60%+ of the wealth of this country is in land. In land and the housing. This is brilliant. You can't move it. You really can't dig it up and move it. And you could have a conspiracy theory. It's one of my favourite. You could tell my very weird fantasies, but one of my favourite fantasies is that George Osborne is actually with you. He's just far cleverer than you. And he's embedded himself in the Conservative Party. He made a decision when he was very young. I must change my name from Gideon to George so that I can become an elected politician. Get in, be Chancellor of the Exchequer. get all the wealth put into housing, get some of the richest people on the planet to come and buy property worth £60 million, and create a situation that's so unstable that we'll have to take a lot of this wealth from them as the only way in which we can carry on in the next few decades. And it gets better. So how can we do that? How can we get the wealth off these people that's held in land and housing? I know. Let's bring in £9,000 a year university fees with an average payback of £56,000 per successful graduate. Because then, when you lot are in your early 30s, and a few of you have done really spectacularly at what job you do, and you're trying to buy that tiny flat in that really dodgy part of London, you'll be lent £56,000 less than you'd ever otherwise be lent. So we've taken out from the entire first buyer cohort purchasing power for housing. Now the alternative, of course, is that you don't buy. You just have to rent for your whole lives. Even if you're a successful LSE graduate who gets a good job, you're going to have to rent. So it's one or the other, because you're not going to be able to purchase this property at this value. I've got more, I mean, not particularly radical, but if you're trying to work out how to, so it's not at all radical. If you're trying to work out how to fund London better, if you're in this part of London and you buy something near here, I don't know, 20 million, 25 million, the tax for, you know, I don't know, four beds and a nice view, the tax on it's only £1,300 a year. That's your council tax. Now, supposing you just added some council tax bands rather than do mansion tax to make it a flat tax. Again, not radical. This is just a flat tax proportional to property values. London could raise an enormous amount of money from a flat tax. The place it would be copying is New York. So it's not radical. What happens to the value of all the property in central London, which is only holding its wealth because of the taxation is so low on the property? Collapses in value. You've seen the house in Bishop's Avenue that's, what's it gone for, 20 million less than it was bought a few months ago? There are ways of taking the wealth away from the very rich that you can blame on the market if you don't put all your effort in to holding the market up. And in fact, it's potentially as easy as not trying really, really hard to keep the very rich rich by defending the value of property. That's,
I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, guys. Sorry.
Yeah,
one more.
I don't know, just isn't what you're arguing just a repeat of history? Like, after World War II, get the slave government, and now we've returned to very similar conditions because of what you just outlined, all those concessions have been seized back. Yeah, not only are they temporary, but surely a vote for the Green Party, which arguably is like a Labour of 45, haven't we tried that route?
Yeah. And it's a really good question to end on.
And there was another part that's going to come. There is an alternative.
Yeah.
We have lived in multi-million pounds properties for free.
Yeah.
You can squat.
Yeah.
And you can build your autonomous movements.
Yeah.
Like the Zapatistas in Mexico, in Cabani at the moment, the Kurds revolution, I think, is really good examples of how things could be done, where it's no kind of like take a little bit from the 1% and then get dominated back. It's just seizing that governance for yourself there and then.
And people who've been out with the Zapatistas come back and then build eco villages in Britain. I mean, it happens. This is why I need your help. There's a complete lack of imagination in progressive politics. So history never repeats. We're not going to get the same thing again. We need an equivalent as imaginative as the idea of having a free health service was in the 1930s. Somebody imagined it. I've actually got the leaflet of the person who said there could be practices. We need an equivalent as imaginative of the idea of demolishing slums and building council estates. That was imaginative at the time. We need an equivalent as imaginative as comprehensive schools, but not just a campaign that says, please give us back comprehensive schools. On every single major issue, everyone we are lacking, this is education, work, housing, whatever, we are lacking those ideas that will seem slightly impossible, probably a bit nice, that people came up with in the past, and they will all be different. We're not going to recreate my 1970s childhood. It wasn't bad, but that's not what we're going to recreate. But at the moment, we don't have people discussing what their utopia will be and how to get there. The nice news, just want to end on, is next year is the 500th year anniversary of Thomas More's utopia. So there are going to be loads of books published by people's various versions of this. But the bad news is there are going to be people at my age who know how to get on with publishers. And what we need is people to suggest, and it's got to be specific, it's got to be, what kind of education would you like? It doesn't necessarily have to be schools. What would a university of 30 years' time, what could it be like? How could we look after our health and have a good health system rather than a health service being sick? But you can't just say autonomous movements and all being nice and discussing everything. You've got to come up with short descriptions of possibilities for people to talk about. Because every good thing that's ever happened in the last 200 or 300 years, somebody somewhere wrote a little pamphlet. It's all been done. The vast majority of pamphlets that are ever written, nothing happens with them. But nothing ever becomes and exists and is made without somebody coming up with the idea. And by definition, they have to come up with the idea at a time when it's seen as impossible and silly and stupid. But that's the only way it happens. And you're more likely to get better ideas out of people who don't have rose-tinted glasses like I have and sort of say, oh, if only we could go back to that, that would be good enough. It's got to be, we want more, and what is that more, and how will it be different, and how will that be in the interests of so many other people than what we have at the moment? And if you win that, then you won't just bounce back again to this in another 80 years' time. But it's worldwide. There are people around the world coming up with things. But there's so many fights at the moment against the elite and what they're doing. If we put all our energy into those fights, or to fighting amongst each other, you know, Greens fighting the left, fighting the anarchists and so on, that energy for describing what a better world will be isn't big enough at the moment, and we need more of that. Thank you ever so much for all the attention.